in the limelight.
The spectacular progress of Iran's peaceful nuclear projects, in spite of the hurdles placed in its way by the U.S., the world's most dangerously nuclear-armed country, and the nuclear terrorism of the illegal Zionist entity called Israel, has astounded friends and foes alike. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by the staff of Keihan International. This article is published under the heading Iran's Spectacular Nuclear Progress. Here's more. The spectacular progress of Iran's peaceful nuclear projects, in spite of the hurdles placed in its way by the U.S., the world's most dangerously nuclear-armed country, and the nuclear terrorism of the illegal Zionist entity called Israel, has astounded friends and foes alike. While countries friendly to the Islamic Republic have admiration for Iran's achievements in the interest of peace, development, and eventual independence of the whole region from the West's hegemony, the enemies are wringing their hands in frustration at their failure to deprive the Iranian people of their inalienable right to enrich uranium for industrial, medicinal, agricultural, and other needs. On April 9th, the world's only country that has officially ruled as haram or religiously forbidden the manufacture of any type of weapons of mass destruction marked its annual National Nuclear Technology Day by unveiling its latest progress in this vital field. At the ceremony in Tehran, in presence of President Dr. Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, were put on display three radiopharmaceuticals, two achievements in the fields of cold plasma technology, CPT, and plasma therapy for cancer patients, and another four in the areas of industry, lasers, control systems, and photography. This comes at a time when the United States is making feverish attempts to limit Iran's right for peaceful process of nuclear energy through irrational demands at the Vienna talks, coupled with its policy of economic terrorism, all of which have failed to deter Iranian scientists from exploring new vistas in this arena. At present, Iran has been enriching uranium to various degrees ranging from 5 to 20, and in some cases 60% purity for peaceful industrial use. As stated by President Raisi, Iran does not restrict research and studies on the peaceful aspects of nuclear energy to the wishes or opinions of others. Fortunately, research into the peaceful applications of nuclear energy is growing. He made it clear to those trying to politicize the issue and resorting to sabotage and assassination of Iranian scientists, such as Martyr Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, "Our rapid and major strides in the areas of nuclear technology and expertise are irreversible." Head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, pointed out that last year Iran inaugurated 77 new achievements in the nuclear technology sector, including 29 related to the nuclear fuel, 19 in the field of nuclear research and development, 15 in the field of energy supply, and 14 in the sphere of radiation application. He announced three strategic plans and stated that Iran plans to generate 10,000 megawatts of nuclear power, promote the application of radiation technologies, and construct a fully indigenous 360,000 megawatt power plant in the southwestern city of Darhuen. It is worth noting that in addition to operating IR-1 centrifuge cascades to enrich uranium to 20% purity, Iran has also been enriching uranium in full or near full cascades of IR-2M, IR-4, IR-5, and IR-6, all of them certified by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, as civilian projects. To sum up, whatever the results of the current talks at Vienna, the Islamic Republic of Iran is determined to continue its steady progress for peaceful use of nuclear technology and will defend its achievements with tooth and nail if its enemies resort to any adventurism.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organization, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the US-engineered regime change plot in Pakistan and how Prime Minister Imran Khan thwarted the hideous move. And we shall take a look at political tensions in India, whipped up by a new film that manipulates the truth and portrays Muslims as evil and treacherous.
Regime change plotters were again at it, and they were once again forced to eat humble pie. More than 3 years after assuming power, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan faced the biggest challenge of his political career just recently, with the cricketer-turned-politician clearly outsmarted his internal rivals and external foes. The country's parliament dismissed the no-trust motion against him on the 1st of April, calling it unconstitutional. It asserted that no foreign power will be allowed to topple an elected government through a conspiracy.
After weeks of animated political activity, Pakistan's parliament on Sunday, April the 3rd, rejected the opposition's move to topple the government of Imran Khan. National Assembly Deputy Speaker Qasim Khan Suri said the resolution could not be voted upon as it was supported by foreign elements and violated Article 5 of the country's constitution. In a televised speech later, Khan reiterated that the move to overthrow him was a foreign conspiracy. President Arif Alvi then dissolved parliament at the Prime Minister's request and asked the nation to prepare for a fresh election. Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf leader thus failed to complete his full term, a feat no Prime Minister has been able to accomplish in the country's turbulent history. Before the high-drama vote, the embattled Premier had rejected calls from political rivals to resign, claiming a foreign regime change plot behind the move. The opposition has accused the Parliament Deputy Speaker of committing an unconstitutional act by rejecting the no-confidence vote against the Prime Minister. Pakistan People's Party chief Bilawal Bhutto said the opposition will stage a sit-in until the no-trust vote is held. Now all eyes are on the country's Supreme Court and the military.
Imran Khan's claim of foreign meddling in Pakistan's internal affairs was no bluff. Americans have resorted to the hideous regime change playbook in many countries. Khan and his ministers cited a letter by a senior U.S. government official as proof of a U.S. conspiracy to overthrow the PTI government. The trigger apparently was Khan's recent visit to Moscow at the height of the Ukraine crisis, his refusal to condemn Russia's military operation in Ukraine, as well as his freewheeling criticism of America's botched military exit from Afghanistan.
In a televised address last week, Prime Minister Khan referred to a threatening letter received by Pakistan's outgoing ambassador to Washington, Asad Majid Khan, from a senior U.S. State Department official. The letter was sent to Islamabad on March the 7th, a day before Pakistan's opposition made the first move to push a no-trust motion against Khan in Parliament. The letter warned that U.S.-Pakistan relations will not improve with Khan in power, and that Pakistan will be forgiven once he is ousted. Khan called it the evidence of an international conspiracy to topple his government. Khan and his aides linked the threat to his late February visit to Moscow, the first by a Pakistani premier in 23 years. The timing of the visit, hours before the Kremlin launched a military operation in Ukraine, and his refusal to join the Western bloc in condemning the operation at the UN General Assembly, turned him into a villain.
We share a long history of excellent and strategic relationship with the United States, which remains our largest export market. We seek to broaden and expand our ties with both countries without impacting our relations with the other.
He also lashed out at the European Union for asking him to vote against Russia at the UN, saying they shouldn't treat Pakistan as their slave. So it's pretty clear the move to overthrow him was aided and abetted in foreign shores.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Musharraf Husseini, an Islamic scholar, political commentator and director of Justice Peace London. First of all, welcome to the programme, Mr. Husseini. Now let's begin with Imran Khan surviving the no-trust motion against him in the parliament and that he still won't be able to serve the full term. So how do you see this political crisis unfolding in coming weeks and months?
Yeah, actually, he has survived this time, but the thing is that we need to go into the background and see the background, what happens here. In Pakistan, we have the governments which are always listening to Americans, and it's a long time. The story started with our previous president, in Field Marshal Ayub Khan, and he also wrote down a book, Friends Not Masters, because America was trying to become the master of Pakistan. And although he was invited to America and he had a great reception there and reception in America. But later on, we see that at the time of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, the same thing was being tried. And in the last days of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto as a prime minister, we see he showed a letter which was sent from America, and he wanted to show the proof of Americans. And he said that the white elephant is after me. And then he was taken out of power. And then Ziaul-Haq came. And Ziaul-Haq also ended up in a blast, in this aeroplane was blasted. And people, it's an open secret that people point finger towards the United States about that. And later on, the governments, one after another, there was a musical chairs between Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, and all that stuff was going on. And one after another, everyone was looking towards the dictation from America. Imran Khan is the one who has come after a long time in Pakistan, where he is not listening to the dictations. He's not that type of man to listen to the dictations. He has been playing in the West, and he's familiar with the Western culture.
Now, Mr. Husseini, Prime Minister Khan and his aides have claimed that foreign conspiracy is behind the move to topple his government, blasting the U.S. for ganging up with his political opponents. Now, do you also see the regime change plot?
Yeah, regime change is not a new phenomenon for Americans. We have been going through the Arab Spring, and after that, we saw too many changes there. It was a phenomenon which was brought in by Americans. And they wanted to bring in changes because their puppets in the Middle East, they were getting outdated and they were getting old enough to remain. And there was resentment about them in the public. So they brought in the Arab Spring. And when the governments which came in, they were not according to their wishes, like in Egypt and in other places. They just, Morsi came in and they had to take out Morsi through his other proxies, through Saudis and United Arab Emirates. They played a role in taking them off. Then there was a regime change in revolutions, like in Poland and other places. They brought in the revolutions and to bring in the leaders of their choices there. And moreover, we now see the latest developments that happened, what happened in Libya or in Iraq or in other places. That's very obvious. The Americans were involved in all those regime changes, and it has become a part of their policy now. So sometimes they do it by force, like for Saddam, what they did. Sometimes they do it politically by bringing in revolutions, and sometimes Pakistan, because Pakistani governments for years they have been subservient to the American policy and American dictates. So now they have got enough people in the Pakistani system, so they wanted to take put them in give them the duty of bringing in the change. So I'm very sure, in my opinion, whatever is happening, and which is, it's very obvious that Americans were trying, the American government was trying to bring in the change. Afterward, Imran Khan became with an independent foreign policy and looking towards East, and then having good relations with China, with Russia, with Iran, and with other neighbors, and talking about Islamic thing.
Thank you for being on the program, Mr. Hosseini. Now let's see how people on social media had to say on America's push for regime change in Pakistan.
Hossein Nadeem, executive director at the Islamabad Policy Research Institute, calls regime change and interference in foreign countries a recorded and proven fact, demanding a probe into foreign conspiracy against Imran Khan's government. Minister of Human Rights in Imran Khan's cabinet, Shirin Mazari, says those who pushed the no-trust motion against Khan in parliament were part of an international conspiracy, but the plot was thwarted. Masood Ehsan Bhatti, a Lahore-based university student who notes that the top U.S. diplomat behind the move to overthrow Imran Khan's government did not deny allegations during his recent India visit.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The latest Bollywood blockbuster, The Kashmir Files, is creating ripples in India and racking up record box office sales. It's not a romantic thriller or a biopic drama, but Gobble-style filmmaking that whips up empathy for one side and malice for the other. To invoke critics, it's not even filmmaking, but myth-making at its best. Based on the exodus of Hindus from Kashmir in the late 1980s, the film shows Muslims as villains and Hindus as their helpless victims, thereby providing a distorted vision of history.
Kashmir Files, a movie that claims to chronicle the exodus of Hindus from the Muslim-majority region of Indian-controlled Kashmir between 1989 and 1990, has kicked up a political storm in India. Instead of a fair and accurate portrayal of the tragic episode, the film presents a distorted trajectory of events. It paints Kashmiri Muslims as extraordinarily savage, accusing them of engineering the exodus. It also manages to vilify Muslims in mainland India, showing them as dangerous vultures preying on vulnerable Hindus. The controversial film has whipped up hate against Indian Muslims, with videos on social media showing people who watched it calling Muslims traitors and encouraging Hindus to exterminate them. That's what a distorted cinematic portrayal of historical events can do. Staggering box office numbers and Twitter hashtags are never the barometers of a film's success, but its ability to unite people and heal them are. This film has aggravated the religious discord and hatred in an already polarized Indian society, where marginalization of Muslims has become a mainstream political discourse. The film has been promoted by the Hindu nationalist BJP government in New Delhi, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, with many BJP-ruled states making it tax-free. That, experts believe, sets a dangerous precedent in Indian cinema.
The film The Kashmir Files seeks to mainstream the false propaganda about the exodus of Hindus from the Kashmir Valley. It claims to reveal the truth that there was genocide against them engineered by Muslims and that thousands of them were killed in cold blood. Muslims in mainland India are portrayed in the film as inherently evil, demonic and predatory, justifying the brazen Hindu extremism that has been normalized under the BJP rule. That's precisely why the top BJP leadership has gone out of its way to promote the film.
While a movie made by far-right filmmaker Vivek Agnihotri claims that thousands of Hindus were massacred in Kashmir, official estimates reveal a completely different picture. Kashmir police in a recent memo claimed that only 89 Hindus were killed in the Kashmir Valley since January 1990. India's Home Ministry in December 2017 stated that 174 cases of killing of Kashmiri Hindus had been registered. In March 2010, Kashmir's Legislative Assembly was informed that 219 Kashmiri Hindus were killed since 1989. In contrast, thousands of Kashmiri Muslims have been killed over the past three decades, many of them lying in unmarked mass graves. The film also resorts to the trope employed by radical Hindu groups in India to attack Muslims, alleging a conspiracy by Muslim men to lure Hindu women into wedlock to numerically overtake Hindus. The conspiracy theory has been widely used to justify violence against Muslims in recent years. As critics and historians have stressed, the film's storyline isn't even remotely close to what actually happened in Kashmir. Why it's being talked about is because the ruling party, which thrives from divisive politics and misses no opportunity to push its communal agenda, has endorsed the film.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shiva Sundar, an activist and a freelance journalist from Bangalore City. Welcome to the program, sir. As we've seen, the new Bollywood film The Kashmir Files has witnessed phenomenal box office success despite controversies. With this in mind, could we say myth-making sells more than filmmaking in India today?
Yeah, I think that's correct. The myth-making and mystifying the realities are always the blackbusters in the Bollywood movie, but there is something else to this particular movie. The runaway hit is not only because of the interest shown by the audience, it is also manipulated and mobilized. This is a Bollywood hit not only because people have shown in their interest in the theme of the movie, but also because it has acquired the state support. Almost some 20 to 30 states within the Indian country have declared tax-free shows, and the ruling party, that is Bharatiya Janata Party, which rules at the center and in almost 16 states of this country, have actually mobilized the people in a big way. There is a kind of, it was a party program to actually hire the cinema theaters for days and weeks and to show the movie, because it actually helps the propaganda and the political agenda of the ruling party. So there is a two part to this runaway success. One is the general interest in the theme of the movie, because it is about the Kashmiri Pandits, Kashmiri Pandits have not made into the theme of the movies for a long time. But just a year before, there was another movie on the same subject by name Shikara, but it did not fit well into the political interpretation of the ruling party, so it did not get any kind of support or the media support from the established medias of this country. But this particular movie, Kashmiri Files, talks about the Kashmiri Pandits and how it was actually, it is not about even Kashmiri Pandits in that way. The very name is very confusing, because Kashmiri Files in that way means that it is the story of the people of the Kashmir. That way it is not the story of the all the people of the Kashmir. It is only Pandits who are actually the protagonists here, and not even the story of the real story of the Pandits, because many Kashmiri Pandits who now live in the refugee camps in the Jammu part of the Jammu Kashmir state have denied the many scenes and the running story.
Sir, the film, which is based on the exodus of Hindus from Kashmir Valley 3 decades ago, claims that thousands of them were killed. Official figures tell a different story. Now, could you shed some light on the real truth?
Yes, generally when there is a situation of kind of controversy and war, the basic casualty is facts and the truth. In fact, it is true that there was a big exodus of Kashmiri Pandits from the valley in 1990, starting from January 19th of 1990 to say March or April. But the number is very much exaggerated, because very recently, say last year in 2021, on November 27, there was an application filed by a citizen of this country to the according to the Right to Information Act that is passed in this country. We can seek any official information from the any offices of this government. Likewise, there was an application seeking information about the number of terrorists who are killed by the number of Pandits who are killed by the terrorists between January 19th of 1990 to till date. The answer given, the official answer, let me also tell you that since 2019 August 5, the Jammu Kashmir state is under the central rule, presidential rule. That means it is Modi government. So then the DGP of the Jammu Kashmir state gives the information saying that between January 19th of 1990 and 2021 November, altogether 1,722 civilians are killed, out of which only 89 are Kashmir Pandits. Rest are non-Pandits, and most of them happen to be the Muslims. This is the real story. It is not to say that Kashmiri Pandits were not killed. It is not to say that there was a big anxiety among the Kashmiri Pandits that their lives will be under jeopardy if they continue to live in the valley. But the way it is portrayed as if it was a big holocaust is not true, because till the whole 30 years, according to the government information itself, it is only 89 Pandits who are killed, and each and every life is actually important. Even 89 is a big number in that sense. But the other part of the story is that the target of the terrorists were not religious target, because more people who are killed by the terrorists in this period, civilians who are killed by the terrorists, are Muslims.
Now, the top leadership of the Hindu nationalist ruling party in India, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, has endorsed the film. So it seems that it serves the BJP's divisive communal agenda.
Of course. It's not only Narendra Modi. Right from Narendra Modi to many BJP chief ministers ruling different states and all the BJP organizations and the RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is the ideological guru of the ruling dispensation, and their organizations, they have all endorsed the movie, and they have said that this is the complete truth, and this helps them in a big way. Because what is the lie that is concocted by this ruling government? It is to say that except BJP, no government was actually considering the plight of the Pandits in the Jammu, in the Kashmir Valley. And Kashmiri Muslims, the whole Kashmiri Muslims, are pro-Pakistan and anti-national. And this is the story actually right from 1953. The BJP's earlier avatar was Bharatiya Janasangh. The founder of Bharatiya Janasangh was Shyam Prasad Mukherjee. Since 1953, It is the story that is being dished out to the people of this country that every person, 90 lakh Muslims who are living in the Kashmir Valley, are pro-Pakistan and are helping the terrorists. And it is only under the Modi regime that Kashmir is completely integrated into India, and Article 370 was a big hurdle, which is actually Congress and other ruling parties helped the Kashmiri Valley to disassociate with Kashmir, with India. But this is again half-truth, because Article 370 was completely accepted by the Constitution Assembly of India, wherein Shyam Prasad Mukherjee was also a member. Sardar Patel, whom the BJP government held in high reverence, was also the member.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Shiva Sundar for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
A columnist at Toronto Star, Shri Paradkar, blasts the makers of new Bollywood film Kashmir Files, saying the distortion of true events in the film was eliciting strong visceral reactions from Hindus against Muslims. Rana Ayub, a prominent Indian journalist and Washington Post columnist, blames the Hindu nationalist BJP government and Prime Minister Narendra Modi for promoting, propagating and facilitating a film that has amplified hate against Muslims in India. A senior journalist with Telegraph newspaper, Sanjay K. Jha, cites Indian politician and former minister Sharad Pawar as saying that the BJP was creating a poisonous atmosphere by spreading false propaganda through films like Kashmir Files.
And that was our episode about the US bid to topple the Imran Khan government in Pakistan, and also films being used as a political tool to stoke communal tensions and divisions in India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Artificial intelligence has been identified as one of the top three emerging technologies in conservation, helping protect species around the world. We now present you an article written by Graham Greene. The piece is titled Five Ways Artificial Intelligence is Saving Wildlife, from counting chimps to locating whales. There's a strand of thinking, from sci-fi films to Stephen Hawking, that suggests artificial intelligence could spell doom for humans. But conservationists are increasingly turning to artificial intelligence as an innovative technology solution to tackle the biodiversity crisis and mitigate climate change. A recent report by wildlabs.net found that artificial intelligence was one of the top three emerging technologies in conservation. From camera trap and satellite images to audio recordings, the report notes, artificial intelligence can learn how to identify which photographs out of thousands contain rare species, or pinpoint an animal call out of hours of field recordings, hugely reducing the manual labor required to collect vital conservation data. Artificial intelligence is helping to protect species as diverse as humpback whales, koalas, and snow leopards, supporting the work of scientists, researchers and rangers in vital tasks, from anti-poaching patrols to monitoring species. With machine learning, computer systems that use algorithms and models to learn, understanding and adapt, artificial intelligence is often able to do the job of hundreds of people, getting faster, cheaper and more effective results. Here are five artificial intelligence projects contributing to our understanding of biodiversity and species. 1. Stopping poachers. Zambia's Kafue National Park is home to more than 6,600 African savanna elephants and covers 22,400 square kilometers. So stopping poaching is a big logistical challenge. Illegal fishing in Lake Itezi on the park's border is also a problem, and poachers masquerade as fishers to enter and exit the park undetected, often under the cover of darkness. The Connected Conservation Initiative from Game Rangers International, Zambia's Department of National Parks and Wildlife and other partners is also using artificial intelligence to enhance conventional anti-poaching efforts, creating a 19-kilometer-long virtual fence across Lake Itezi. Forward-looking infrared thermal cameras record every boat crossing in and out of the park, day and night. Installed in 2019, the cameras were monitored manually by rangers, who could then respond to signs of illegal activity. Forward-looking infrared artificial intelligence has now been trained to automatically detect boats entering the park, increasing the effectiveness and reducing the need for constant manual surveillance. Waves and flying birds can also trigger alerts, so the artificial intelligence is being taught to eliminate these false readings. Ian Hode, Special Technical Advisor at Game Rangers International, says there have long been insufficient resources to secure protected areas, and having people watch multiple cameras 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, doesn't scale. Artificial intelligence can be a game changer, as it can monitor for illegal boat crossings and alert ranger teams immediately. The technology has enabled a handful of rangers to provide around-the-clock surveillance of a massive illegal entry point across Lake Itezi. Two, tracking water loss. Brazil has lost more than 15% of its surface water in the past 30 years, a crisis that has only come to light with the help of artificial intelligence. The country's rivers, lakes, and wetlands have been facing increasing pressure from a growing population, economic development, deforestation, and the worsening effects of the climate crisis. But no one knew the scale of the problem until last August, when using machine learning, the MAP Biomass Water Project released its results after processing more than 150,000 images generated by NASA's Landsat 5, 7, and 8 satellites from 1985 to 2020 across the 8.5 million square kilometer of Brazilian territory. Without artificial intelligence, researchers could not have analyzed water changes across the country at the scale and level of detailed needed. Artificial intelligence can also distinguish between natural and human-created water bodies. The Negro River, a major tributary of the Amazon River and one of the world's 10 largest rivers by volume, has lost 22% of its surface water. The Brazilian portion of the Pantanal, the world's largest tropical wetland, has lost 74% of its surface water. Such losses are devastating for wildlife. 4,000 species of plants and animals live in the Pantanal, including jaguars, tapirs, and anacondas, people and nature. Cassio Bernardino, World Wildlife Fund, Brazil's MAP Biomass Water Project lead, says, "Artificial intelligence technology provided us with a shockingly clear picture. Without artificial intelligence and machine learning technology, we would never have known how serious the situation was, let alone had the data to convince people. Now we can take steps to tackle the challenges this loss of surface water poses to Brazil's incredible biodiversity and communities." Number 3. Finding whales. Knowing where whales are is the first step in putting measures such as marine protected areas in place to protect them. Locating humpback whales visually across vast oceans is difficult, but their distinctive singing can travel hundreds of miles underwater. At National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association fisheries in the Pacific Islands, acoustic recorders are used to monitor marine mammal populations at remote and hard-to-access islands. Anne Allen, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association research oceanographer, says, "In 14 years, we've accumulated around 190,000 hours of acoustic recordings. It would take an exorbitant amount of time for an individual to manually identify whale vocalizations." In 2018, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, NOAA, partnered with Google Artificial Intelligence for Social Good's bioacoustics team to create a machine learning model that could recognize humpback whale songs. Four, protecting koalas. Australia's koala populations are in serious decline due to habitat destruction, domestic dog attacks, road accidents and bushfires. Without knowledge of their numbers and whereabouts, saving them is challenging. Grant Hamilton, Associate Professor of Ecology at Queensland University of Technology in Australia, has created a conservation artificial intelligence hub with Federal and Landcare Australia funding to count koalas and other endangered animals. Using drones and infrared imaging, an artificial intelligence algorithm rapidly analyzes infrared footage and determines whether a heat signature is a koala or another animal. Grant Hamilton used the system after Australia's devastating bushfires in 2019 and 2020 to identify surviving koala populations, particularly on Kangaroo Island. Grant Hamilton says, "This is a game-changer project to protect koalas. Powerful artificial intelligence algorithms are able to analyze countless hours of video footage and identify koalas from many other animals in the thick bushland. The system will allow land care groups, conservation groups, and organizations working on protecting and monitoring species to survey large areas anywhere in Australia and send the data back to us at the Queensland University of Technology to process it." Number five, counting species. Saving species on the brink of extinction in the Congo Basin, the world's second largest rainforest, is a huge task. In 2020, data science company Apsilon teamed up with the University of Stirling in Scotland and Gabon's National Parks Agency to develop the Mambaza artificial intelligence image classification algorithm for large-scale biodiversity monitoring in Gabon's Lopé and Waka national parks. Conservationists had been using automated cameras to capture species including African forest elephants, gorillas, chimpanzees and pangolins, which then had to be manually identified. Millions of pictures could take months or years to classify, and a country that is losing about 150 elephants each month to poachers, time matters. The Mabaza artificial intelligence algorithm was used in 2020 to analyze more than 50,000 images collected from 200 camera traps spread across 7,000 square kilometers of forest. Mabaza artificial intelligence classifies up to 3,000 images an hour and is up to 96% accurate. Conservationists can monitor and track animals and quickly spot anomalies or warning signs, enabling them to act swiftly when needed. The algorithm also works offline on an ordinary laptop, which is helpful in locations with no or poor internet connectivity.
Thank you. the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tel Aviv has been the scene of yet another Palestinian operation. On Thursday, a Palestinian man opened fire at Israelis in the heart of a city, killing three and injuring eight others. He was shot dead by Israeli forces after a nine-hour manhunt. Palestinian resistance groups praised the attack as a heroic operation, calling it a natural response to Israeli crimes. The Popular Resistance Committee, a coalition of a number of armed Palestinian groups, says the operation exposed the regime's fragility and weakness. The comments were echoed by Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah, which hailed the recent shooting operation in Tel Aviv as a legitimate response to crimes committed by the Israeli regime. Thursday's attack was the fourth such operation in the past 2 weeks. Late last month, a Palestinian shooting operation killed five people in a Tel Aviv suburb. Attacks in the northern city of Hadera and the southern city of Beersheba had killed six Israelis days earlier. But the question is, what's behind the uptick in the number of attacks that's been described as one of the deadliest waves of Palestinian operations in years?
We are suffering daily from their homes being confiscated, their lives being taken, children being arrested on an almost daily basis and taken off to jail. So for every action, there is a reaction, and repression builds resistance. So I think we are seeing an outcry of despair, but also a strengthening of resistance against the continued illegal occupation of the West Bank.
As tensions mount in the occupied territories, Israel is bracing for more Palestinian operations in the days to come. The events that are unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of hostilities that culminated in the 11-day war on Gaza in May last year, during which over 250 Palestinians, including scores of women and children, were killed in the besieged enclave. The international community called for an immediate end to the war, but stopped short of condemning Israel for the deadly and devastating onslaught after it was over. The world also seems to have turned a blind eye to Israel's land grab and expansionist policies that see hundreds of Palestinian-owned structures razed to the ground every year. The years-long blockade on Gaza Strip, settlers' violence against Palestinians, and Israel's illegal settlement construction activities also seem to be going unnoticed. When some Arab states announced the normalization of ties with Israel, they claimed that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering.
You've mentioned all the usual suspects who give political coverage and the fig leaf of respectability to the apartheid Israeli regime, remembering that Israel is a white colonial European colonization project within the Middle East. But you've left out the other group of people, the other organization that have condemned Palestinian violence, but have not condemned Israeli violence, and that is the Palestinian Authority, which is led by the unelected Mahmoud Abbas. So while all these other people are held to account for their failure to hold to account Israeli apartheid atrocities and war crimes, let us not forget the PA and Mahmoud Abbas.
In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
The world will never forget the gruesome killing of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi by a Saudi hit squad in 2018. Khashoggi was strangled at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then dismembered by a forensic scientist who worked for Saudi intelligence. The killing was caught on listening devices planted by Turkish intelligence. The Saudi dissident's body was then cut to pieces and taken to the Turkish Consul General's residence, where it is believed to have been burned. No remains have ever been found. The brutal murder severely strained ties between Ankara and Riyadh and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish exports. It cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was particularly vociferous in his condemnation of the Saudi government. He said Khashoggi was killed in cold blood by a death squad sent from Riyadh, and that it had been established that his murder was premeditated. The Turkish president said the operation had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government. His assessment was supported by a U.S. intelligence report which said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had personally approved the assassination. There has been almost no doubt that the order to kill came from very high up in the Saudi government. And Turkey was widely seen as the most unrelenting force behind efforts to bring those responsible for the assassination to justice. But Ankara has suddenly changed course. On Thursday, a Turkish court halted the trial of Saudi suspects and transferred the case to Saudi Arabia. The Turkish court's ruling has been widely denounced. Rights groups called the move an appalling whitewash. Khashoggi's Turkish fiancée says she has been surprised and saddened by the decision, which she described as political. Following the court's ruling, Hatice Cengiz said Saudi Arabia is a country where there is no justice and that no one expects a just decision there. She also pledged to appeal the court ruling. The Turkish U-turn on the murder trial comes as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is trying to mend ties with the Saudis. The Khashoggi case has been a major obstacle to warmer political relations between the two sides. But why does Turkey need to reset its ties with the oil-rich kingdom so much? Turkey is grappling with a severe economic downturn, and the Turkish leader is facing an election next year.
I think it has everything to do with trying to mend ties with Saudi Arabia. I think Turkey has been chasing reconciliation with its former antagonist. We've seen that it's reconciled with the UAE. We've seen that it's been making concessions to Egypt, that it's been restricting the activity of Egyptian opposition in Istanbul and telling Egyptian opposition critics in Istanbul to tone down their criticism of Sisi in a bid to try to get Egypt to accept a reconciliation. And likewise, we're seeing Turkey make strenuous efforts in order to convince Mohammed bin Salman to end the Saudi boycott of Turkish goods.
Riyadh had made it clear to Ankara that a thaw could only come if Ankara drops the case against the kingdom. The Turkish court's ruling has left little doubt that cash-strapped Ankara wants a thaw in ties with the wealthy Saudis to such an extent that it is willing to drop the high-profile case for good.
So what Turkey's essentially doing, it's handing the issue over to Saudi Arabia and saying, for us, the matter is closed, and we're going to allow you to close the matter as well permanently so that nobody officially in the international community can talk about Khashoggi anymore.
Saudi petrodollars seem to be once again giving the kingdom impunity for its horrific crimes.
Russia has warned the West against disrupting peace talks with Ukraine.
Foreign Minister Lavrov says Russia believes the West is enabling hysteria around the alleged mass killings in the Ukrainian town to derail the peace talks between Moscow and Kiev. We tend to think that the reason lies in the desire to find a reason to disrupt the ongoing negotiations, and to do it exactly at the moment when, as they say, the light, even if not bright, but nevertheless began to dawn. According to Lavrov, in the course of negotiations with Russia, Kiev had for the first time put on paper its readiness to declare itself neutral, not aligned to any bloc, and non-nuclear. Lavrov insisted that the Ukrainians had formalized a refusal to deploy the weapons of foreign states on their territory or to conduct exercises there with the participation of a foreign military without the consent of all guarantor states of the future treaty, including Russia. The remarks by the Russian top diplomats highlight the possibility that Ukraine's Western backers may have different motivations or reservations about a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. For some NATO countries, the war between Ukraine and Russia is preferable to a peace deal.
Well, obviously, Ukraine is being utilized by NATO in a very dangerous experiment. And it's not the first time this has happened. This has really been kind of a century-old project dating back to after the First World War, when there was an attempt to prevent the growth of large major countries like Germany and Russia, so that Central Europe has always been used by, in those days, by the British and these days by the Americans as a wedge against any major country that might become a competitor.
There is a long track record of influential foreign policy thinkers who suggested America would benefit from Russia fighting an insurgency in Ukraine. The latest official to express the benefits of Ukrainian insurgency is U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Carle. I think with a high degree of certainty that Russia will emerge from Ukraine weaker than it went into the conflict. Militarily weaker, economically weaker, politically and geopolitically weaker, and more isolated.
Unfortunately, the United States is continuing to work, as they did after World War II in Ukraine, against the Soviet Union, to ally themselves with extremely right-wing forces who earlier had been associated with the Nazis. And that is a real factor in Ukraine. It's undeniable. And the United States is playing with them as a tool in a game against Russia. It's hard to say what the end game there is.
U.S. officials say they are skeptical that the Ukrainian government's negotiations with Russia will lead to a swift deal. And they are considering how a settlement will impact the security of NATO nations. Some European countries, especially formerly communist ones, are especially nervous about how the conflict will evolve. They believe if Russia feels it has profited from the invasion, it may eventually be inspired to try the same thing against other neighbors. NATO leaders say the Ukrainians are involved in a broader fight on behalf of Europe. Even a Ukrainian vow not to join NATO could be a concern for some neighbors. Therefore, it appears that for some in NATO, it's better for the Ukrainians to keep fighting and dying than to achieve peace. They believe the peace deal would come too early or at too high a cost to Kiev and the rest of Europe. European members themselves do not appear united on how much of a direct threat Russia poses to the alliance. Germany and France are more inclined than their allies in Eastern Europe to feel that Moscow's aims stop at the NATO border. For countries that are closer to the war, there is a belief that they have more at stake.
Violent clashes between Sri Lankan police and anti-government protesters across the country have become commonplace in recent days. The protesters are angry at the government's handling of the country's worst economic